welcome back to another episode of Keep Looking Up. I'm your host, Caroline Craddock. So as you guys know, for the month of July, we are celebrating the life of my dad, Kid Craddock, and I have been interviewing lots of incredible people who he either worked with or influenced in a major way. And I was just telling my current guest that it's been a very healing process. So I'm very excited to have a conversation with him. So we are going to intro Dr. J-Mac Slaughter. If you know me, you know J-Mac. He is all over my social media. We have been friends since I was a little girl, and we're going to talk the full story, but we really have had a beautiful friendship throughout the years that has transitioned into just a beautiful working relationship. We support each other in each other's philanthropic endeavors. So he's someone that was very influenced by my dad, and now he is a role model for me. And so I'm very excited to speak with Dr. J-Mac Slaughter.
Woo! Thanks for having me, friend. I love that we're doing this. What? When did I almost make you cry?
I look up to you, and you looked up to dad, and it's very full circle, and I love
you. So sweet. Well, I look up to you too. We all look up to each other.
We're all looking up all the time.
And we should keep looking.
So J-Mac, we're going to get into your career and everything, but I want to start from the beginning and talk about how you met dad, the boy band experience, how that led you to the rest of your life, and I think the biggest thing that I want to discuss with you is pivoting. It's been something that I've really noticed about the influential people in my life is that they're very, very good at pivoting. And when I was working on this, that is the word that came to mind when I think of you, because you've pivoted in so many ways where you're still doing the work that you want to do, but you're doing it in maybe a way that you didn't think you were going to be executing this in the past, right?
You're so right. You're so right. I mean, you know, I am so, so, so fortunate to have had the opportunities that I've had growing up. I mean, just like long life story short, I grew up in a Partridge Family. I was singing with my sisters and my dad on stage. My mom's an incredible musician, but she has terrible stage fright. So she was like the stage manager and made sure we were all wearing matching outfits. And she like ran sound and like booked our gigs and stuff. The Von Trapps, yeah. And then, you know, later on I did Casa Miñana and everything. And I always wanted to do something big. And I always dreamed of being on a big, big stage. And I didn't know how I was going to do it. But I knew if I just kept working my tail off, one day, hopefully that opportunity would present itself. And through your dad's radio show, it did. They held a contest to put together a boy band. And it was going to be a big old joke. It was just going to be a bit thing, you know. And they had all the listeners vote on who was going to be in the boy band and everything. But
what year was this?
This was the
year and how old you were too.
I think this was 1998, probably 1999, and I was 15 years old. So I was young.
You were too young.
I was too young. Yeah, I was supposed to be 16 to even audition for the band, but I lied. I didn't feel bad about it at all.
No, because look at where it led you.
I know. And then, so it was going to be just a bit on his show, but then he had us, you know, do our first concert and 4,000 people showed up.
Amazing.
And he was like, I think we have something here. Yeah. And he was like, well, let's help these kids out. And so he gave us a platform on his show and he let us, you know, open up at all the big like Kissmas concerts and whatever the summer thing was, the big summer concert was. Summer Bash. There we go. Yeah. So there was like, we were opening up for Bon Jovi. We were opening up for Hanson and Jessica Simpson and all these big things. And then, you know, you do enough of those and then another big act kind of gets in a bind. And B.B. Mac was on tour with Destiny's Child.
B.B. Mac.
Until you're back here, baby.
I always thought it was shave your back hair, baby.
No, you didn't actually think that. You did not.
But so they got sick or something. Anyway.
Yeah, that's true. That's amazing you can remember that actually from when you were... Yeah. But they got sick. And then next thing we knew, Destiny's Child was like, come on tour with us. And we're like, okay.
Insane.
And so, so cool. But then it just led me to other things. And I ended up, you know, being in LA and talking to record producers, but everybody wanted like 7-year deals and 8-year deals. And that terrified me as a 17-year-old dude who like didn't know what he wanted, other than I knew I wanted to like play my music that I had been singing and, you know, writing behind the scenes. And the boy band was a very bittersweet thing for me because I had always wanted to perform in front of 30,000 people and 50,000. And I got to do that, but it wasn't doing what I wanted to do musically, you know? And so I left that and got, you know, pulled into some real sketchy stuff in LA with recording. And my dad was like paying for all this stuff out of pocket. And the producer was like some like crackhead dude. And, but it seriously, like very, very sketchy stuff happening. But then it just, with networking, ended up leading me to a really legit manager who ended up connecting me to a really legit talent agency who got me some amazing auditions. And I ended up doing TV and film for 4 years. And then after that, you know, decided to become a doctor, just a normal pathway.
Okay, let's not skirt over that. Yeah. Okay. So pivot number one, I would say for you, would be the transition from acting and singing to medicine. And yeah. He also left out that part. So how old were you when you left LA?
So when I left LA, I think I was 21. I was 20 or 21.
So at 21, all of his friends were going off to college and J-Mac had been living in LA since he was 17. So when he decided that he wanted to do medicine, keep in mind, he didn't even have his undergrad yet at 21.
Right, yeah.
You had to start undergrad at 21.
Oh, man.
And I know we had some kids in my class that transferred as juniors and had started as freshmen. And it was like, I can imagine that took some humility because you think you're cool at 21. The fact you have to like go back.
You're like the old guy on campus.
Yeah,
you're the old guy.
Like doing the undergrad thing. But so that was your first transition.
Yeah, dude. I remember being in one of my first classes, you know, literally like day one, lecture one for all like the pre-med kids that wanted to be doctors. And there were these kids behind me and they were freshmen and they were like, in my Spanish class earlier, there was this one girl and she was 20. And the other girl was like, it's so old.
Ew.
And I was like, oh, no.
So how did I know your family, you have a lot of family members that have been in medicine, but taking that plunge when you had already invested the time and money and energy into trying to have this music career to something that's, you have a long road ahead.
Oh, yeah. Everybody told me not to.
Right. That's not a
everybody.
Fix. So
everybody's like, why do you want to do this again? Like, because, you know, not to brag, but I was making a lot of money as a 19-year-old working as an actor per week. I would make, you know, I would make more in a week than I could ever make in even a month of being a doctor, you know? So that was amazing money and money that like my family had never seen come in a short amount of time like that. So they were like, I think you should probably keep doing this.
Yeah.
And I was like, but this is cool and everything, but is this what I should be doing when I'm 40 and when I'm 50? And if not, why the hell would I wait to transition to what is right? Because if this isn't right, I need to find that now while I'm young, you know?
What was that thought process like with that risk factor being so high? And what voice was it inside of you that you were like, I need to do this?
Well, I broke down. What happened was I had so much momentum and I was doing so much all day, every day in the world of entertainment until after the movie. So it was just, I mean, all day, every day from boy band to solo career, to TV and film auditions, to booking TV and film stuff. And then kind of the final straw was, and it was financially a good final straw, was I got paid to not work. A network, it's called an exclusivity contract, talent hold. I don't even know if they have these anymore because Hollywood used to have FU money. I don't know if it has as much FU money as it did. Yeah. But they paid me 6 figures to not work for another network.
Wow.
And so for 8 months, I was like waiting for them to give me the right project. It didn't come about, but everybody was like, that's the dream job, bro. You're getting paid to not work. And like, anybody like listening to this right now can probably just tell, like, this is my normal energy level. I can't, with my energy level, if I don't have somewhere to focus it, it's like torture. It's like Chinese water torture to have this energy and like not have somewhere to put it. My body feels like it's going to explode. And so when I was in the process of, you know, this talent hold contract, I was distracting myself with weightlifting, with surfing, with mountain biking, with like going out and just being crazy, like partying really crazy. Fortunately, I never got into drugs, but I'd go and I'd party until the sun came up on a pretty regular basis. And then at the end of one of those sessions, I was playing strip poker with people I didn't know. And I ended up like with my dog, we're like doing a skateboard around the block to like exhaust her so I could sleep more during the day. And I hit a puddle and I fell and I broke my hand, and it took away all of that stuff that I was doing to distract myself from the fact that I was unhappy, that I had no like purpose in my life except for sitting around and waiting for things to come to me. And I was like, that's not how my life's going to be. So what is it going to be? And I called my mom.
Say this. This is interesting. I didn't realize you had like an epiphany moment.
It did. It was a moment. When I broke my hand, it took all of the distractions away. And I called my mom, and I didn't know why I was calling her, but she knew. She knew it. I didn't even have to say anything to her. She just said, "It's okay to come home." That's what she said. And I just like fell on the ground in a ball because I was lonely. You know, it was like I was doing big stuff. I was making all this money and stuff, but I was lonely. I missed my family. I missed my friends. I had a good support group like in San Diego, but that's not where I lived. I lived in LA, and I needed that day-to-day growth and something to apply myself to. And ultimately, I also kind of realized through that time when I was distracting myself with everything that like the entertainment world can be very self-serving, you know? And like, look at me and I'm beautiful and you know, got like all of these things revolved around me. And I wanted to find a way to where I could use my energy to like give to other people, you know? And that's, and I couldn't, there aren't that many things out there where you can really do that, you know? And my sister at the time was telling me all these really cool stories about being in the emergency room and, you know, taking care of people as they're dying or their loved ones get this crazy diagnosis or somebody gets stabbed in the neck or like whatever it is. And I'm like, that's as real as it gets. Like that's as close to positively impacting another person's life with your energy and your training as you could possibly get. And so that's why that transition happened.
Wow. I love that. That's really encouraging to hear. Cause that's a huge risk. And I know so many people have, I've been thinking a lot about, and I posted this on Instagram the other day, about trading in the life that you think you're supposed to have, life that you're meant to have. Mm. So I know a lot of people nowadays too, especially, are looking for that resounding voice inside them that says you need to make a shift, but it can be so, so scary.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
So the fact that you took that plunge is incredible. And I know it was humbling too. But I also want to say what struck a chord with me too, is your mom giving you that permission to come home. Like sometimes need permission to come home and get back to our roots and figure out who we are and recalibrate. And there's nothing wrong with that. And that,
how lucky am I that she knew the exact right thing to say at the exact right moment. And it just, I mean, it's like, I literally collapsed. I fell to the floor. I fell to the floor crying.
Sometimes we just need that permission. That's
brutal. Yeah, totally. Totally. But once I committed, it was just like full steam ahead, you know, and there was nothing that was going to stop me.
Tell me what happened after that. So you're in undergrad, you are at TCU, you end up getting into med school, you marry your sweet wife, Rebecca.
Yeah.
I was very much in your life at that time after you had your first son, J-Mac. And
you reintroduced music into my life.
Oh, J-Mac.
Oh man, I could cry talking about it, but I turned my back on it. I was done with it. It was too emotional for me to perform. It was too emotional for me to even pick up my guitar. Because you were like, I want to do these performances. We're going to record them on YouTube and I want to do these live shows. Play with me. Play a guitar for me and sing backup for me. And I was like, am I that guy still? Do I still have that? And I didn't, like, that was a rediscovery of a person that I used to be like 8 years ago, you know, 9 years ago. It'd been a long time since I've done that. And you reconnected me with like one of my biggest passions in life, and that's music. And so like, I don't think I've ever said that. It's like too emotional to talk about, you know, but like, I mean, you gave me permission. You gave me permission to re-explore that side of my heart and my being.
You've never said that to me before.
I know. It's true though. It's true.
That's so nice. Well, and for reference, so from my side of the story, I met J-Mac when I was, so it was 1998, I was 8. So I was, I think, second or not to make you feel old, but.
I'm so old, especially when you say that. Oh
no, because that was an age that, and I'm an only child. And so meeting like teenagers was a big deal for me at the time. And I remember my dad very intentionally kept bringing you up and how he wanted to introduce us because, I mean, if I was eight, you were what, 15? So it's not like at that time, it seems like a big age group.
Oh, it was a world of difference. Yeah, at that age, totally.
But I was also starting to get into music and he saw you as someone that had music around him all the time from a very young start. And so I think he just wanted us to connect. And I remember, and I've told the story when I had you on Caroline's Obsessions, but you made such an impact on me at that young age by like actually sitting with me and asking me questions and engaging with me. And then from there, we would randomly see each other in high school.
Do you think your dad just knew it? You think he just like had a sixth sense about it?
Yes, he was really, he introduced me to one of like the only really good boyfriend I've ever had in high school. He we were at a concert and he was like, this guy's been talking.
He just has a gut. Your dad just has a gut feeling about things.
Not to say that he didn't have his moments of, he always saw the best in people. So sometimes he would get taken advantage of, but
yeah.
Very, very, very good about seeing people's character. And
well, I just remember, I mean, that was one of the biggest, the night we met was one of the biggest nights of my entire life. The most like impacting, overwhelming. Now, it was the first time that I performed in front of like 20,000 people before. And so I'm just having like, I mean, literally I had an outer body experience on stage. I wasn't looking through my eyes. I was like behind myself in the background while I was on autopilot, the craziest experience of my life, followed with Kid Craddock before and after, just like, you got to meet Caroline. You got to meet Caroline. When are we going to do this? You got to meet Caroline. Wait around after the show. We got to connect you guys. And like, he just, it was mandatory. That was his goal that night. My goal that night was, you know, like people are pulling me in 100 different directions, but he had like one mission and that was to connect us. And he did it. I'm so glad he did.
I am too. And I think the fact that we both remember it so vividly,
it's
just like so impactful. I think, I don't know why it was impactful for you because I was eight, but for me, it meant a lot. And
I remember there was like a solitary picnic bench with like a tin roof and like single light, you know, hanging from that little roof. That's it. It was, and there were, and of all the people that were there, of all of the glitz and the glamour and the 20,000 fans, it was just you and me in that moment eating mashed potatoes, talking about whatever you talk about with an 8-year-old when you're 15. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But it was so impactful for me at the time too. Mm. And then, we always had mutual friends that would keep up when I was in high school and when you were in LA. But then when my dad passed, and this is why, my relationship with you and Ryan Cabrera.
Oh, yeah.
So important and special to me because you and I had our own like semi-relationship, but we would see each other, but it was very intentional for both of you to befriend me.
Yes.
I think as a way to, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but I know we've talked about in the past, as a way to honor him and like make sure that he knows I'm taken care of. And so you're two people that really, 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 really stood up and were there for me in my time of need when there was no strings. You guys did not need to do that. And
we did though. Your dad changed our life. Your dad changed our life forever. And like, I don't know, somebody skeptical would be like, no, J-Mac, you were meant to go on and do all these great things. And like, that's great. But like, how do I get to this point right now? And how did I have so many ridiculous opportunities? It all started with your dad. It all started with your dad. And I just felt called. I felt called to call you and to be in your life. And I knew that it was the right thing to do for kid, but also I saw that 8-year-old girl, you know, I connected with that 8-year-old girl that lost her daddy, even though you're in your 20s at the time, you know? And I knew I needed to be there. And I'm so glad that I got to be in that moment. And I'm so glad that we're still in each other's lives like this.
I know. We could just literally sit and cry on here for 2 hours.
It's true. It's so true.
Crybabies. But what was cool, like he said, our music journeys are a little bit similar in a way where I was full throttle at OCU doing music. I thought I was going to do musical theater forever. And then when my dad passed, I was only a year out of college. I had no idea what I was going to do. And I had to kind of put everything on hold to take care of the charity and my dad's business. And now looking back, I'm like, a ding dong, like a 23-year-old ding dong was literally handed so much. Like, I have grace for myself, but I didn't know what the hell I was doing.
Who would have? Who would have? Nobody.
It was
nobody.
A lot. I was happy to have such good.
You were
people.
Given an impossible situation.
Yeah. But music was a thing that I had kind of gotten away from. And I think we all kind of found it at the same time. Yeah. And so it was really interesting. Once I was like, I need to start putting my covers or something on YouTube. And I had, when I called J-Mac, I thought he was still kind of doing all this stuff on the side. So the fact that you're just now telling me that you kind of like hadn't been doing music, I had no clue.
I mean, my guitar was dusty. My fingers were slow on that thing. I mean, I had to like rediscover who I was as a performer and as a musician. And, it gave me that confidence back. It reintroduced myself to somebody that I had like pushed into a closet and, you know, shut the light off and closed the door. And I thought I was done with that part of my life. But it gave me permission to explore that person again.
And I think that, and not to sound woo-woo, but I think with how much my dad loved music, there's no coincidences there that he was the one that kind of ended up bringing us back to it. And even when I started really focusing on it and went on American Idol, my whole reasoning was so I can get exposure for kids, which is my dad, you know? It always kind of goes back to him, especially since that was our common denominator. So I think that was, you know, that's not for anyone but dad doing that.
I know.
But speaking of that person that you felt like was kind of locked up, I think there's so much duality in having a career and then also having your passions and things.
Yeah.
How do you, like, once that person came back in your life, I'm sure you realize the impact of not having that in your life.
Yeah.
But how important do you think that is for people who may be struggling with that on trying to manage both so that you don't lose that passion and you can still have all of these beautiful things in your life and not just
for anybody that feels like they have to put all of their time and attention into the performing arts or the arts in general or whatever your passion is, you're wrong. You're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. You don't have to make money doing something for it to benefit you and benefit others. It's something that just brings, if it's something that brought just true joy and passion into your heart and into your life when you were younger, it's gonna do that same thing even though you're older. Sure, like my ability to, if I were to like go 100% in right now as, you know, a 39-year-old dude, you know, if I were to do that, there's no way that I would reach the same level of success as if I were like 20 and pushing really hard at that. But it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to all be about, you know, how many streams you get or how many people show up to your show or something. You allow yourself to let it feed your soul. Free yourself of like needing to be the most successful form of yourself. And it's just going to benefit you and it's going to benefit other people in ways that you can't imagine. And with the nonprofit, I mean, how music ended up like resurging, you know, through the nonprofit and stuff. I mean, I don't know. I feel like right now I'm able to live just my very best life in so many different ways. And that's because I let these things happen instead of trying to be like too controlling and only focus on one thing at a time. I'm letting people in to help support me in these different realms. And I feel so full and happy right now. It's a wonderful place to be.
That's a goal, I think, for everyone. And I think especially for whether it was sports or the arts, whatever it is, I think,
yeah,
especially with Americans in general, with just being wanting to be the best at everything, we're not just allowed to have hobbies. Like I had my aunt in town who her son is 15 and he's really good at lacrosse. And immediately when I heard that, I was like, oh, is he going to get a scholarship? And she said, I don't know. I don't know if he's still going to be doing lacrosse next year. We'll see. But because that's the normal response to that. So like, oh, well, you pick something when you're 15, you're going to do it in college, or this is going to be your thing for the rest of your life. That's a lot of pressure. And so
just totally.
Things that bring you joy,
totally.
And to be able to go back to them, that is something I think, especially in my 30s, I'm exploring that because A, I don't care what people think about me. Some things in your 20s that you want to do, that you want to get back to your child, to your inner child. You're like, never would I do that. It'd be so embarrassing, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Go to an improv class or any of those things. But I feel like you kind of stop caring in your 30s. And so you're willing to kind of go back and see what ignited your soul as a child.
Totally.
Do you feel that way about like?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Again, the same things that like excited you and you were passionate about when you were 15 are going to excite you in your 30s too. You're just afraid to do them now.
Mm-hmm. And I think that is so important with the things that I talk about on if you're in a season where you're feeling very lost, that can be such a good way to re-engage with yourself is doing things that you that brought you joy as a child and just doing it, even though you're going to look cringy, you know,
I think. Yeah.
Just exploring those things. And then you'll get reacquainted with yourself and bring those new parts into your.
Embrace the cringe.
You know,
I need that on a t-shirt. Embrace the cringe.
You have to. Cause the thing is you're cringy until you're not cringy. Like,
yeah, totally. Fake it till you make it.
Influencer or whatever it is. It's so cringy until you're getting those brand deals and then they're not cringy anymore.
Yeah. And then it's like, oh, this is real. Yeah. Like my first brand deal that I did was so cringy. It was like some vitamins and stuff. And I'm like, I didn't really believe in it. I just did it. Cause I was like, this is the thing you do when you're an influencer, you know? And like now it's turned into this thing where like, I truly have figured out how to partner with brands that I love and that I believe in. And they're excited to partner with me as well. And I can make these, something that people would just like want to watch or that have like valuable information in it. And then, but I had to embrace that cringe at first.
Oh yeah. Cause it can be pretty humiliating if you're working so hard on a video and it gets 3 likes and
you're like, oh my God. Yeah.
Now it has to live on the internet forever. Okay. But speaking of all that too, this is a great transition. Pivot number 872.
Yeah. Yeah.
ER doctor who is now a TikTok star. You have over 500,000 followers on TikTok. I'm sure y'all have seen him if you're on TikTok because you show up on my FYP all the time. But what did that look like? How did you start doing all those videos?
Well, so my buddy Travis, shout out to Travis Newman, one of my favorite people in the world. We love Travis. He's the man, dude. I grew up with that kid. He has a successful social media management company. So he has all these influencers and he was like, hey, Jay Mike, have you ever tried TikTok? And I was like, isn't that the app that like young people dance on? And he was like, I mean, yes, but there are people out there that are actually, you know, spreading important information as well. And you can do that in like a fun, lighthearted way. And I was like, nah, I don't know. I don't know about that. And I just kind of ignored him. And then he messaged me again. And then he called me again. And then he messaged me again. He basically just like forced me to do this because he just knew that it would be right for me. God, he was so right. And it changed my life because I went from 0 followers to 200,000 to 400,000. And now like across the platforms, I have over like almost 750,000 followers,
which is just like
crazy to me. And started 2 years ago.
How long did it take you to build that following?
About 2 years. And, I was lucky because I hit it with TikTok at a very important time, you know, like right when there was possibility for just explosive growth. It's hard. It's much harder to grow right now. Mm-hmm. But at the time, I felt like I was missing the boat with TikTok, but I wasn't. I was nailing it. Maybe 6 months before, it would have been even better. But the growth that I was able to achieve in a really short amount of time was insane. But it was not on accident. It was very purposeful. I posted one or more videos every single day. And I went live and I would sit on this live and like talk to people about their health issues or what their experience being in the medical field was for hours at night and just to swirl around a glass of wine, you know, and it was very purposeful. But I feel so lucky because we talk about feeling whole. That's one of the reasons why I feel whole is because I get to be a performer on a regular basis online, and I get to do it. The thing that I thought I was leaving behind in LA was entertainment forever. I thought I was done being an entertainer for the rest of my life, because there's no way that I could see shooting a video in my car or like walking out of the hot. I'll leave a shift after experiencing something that inspires me, or somebody tells me about a story or something like that, and I'll just tell a story to my iPhone. No extra lighting, no extra mic, and just having an honest conversation with my phone and send it out. And some of those videos have gotten 3 million, 4 million, 5 million views. It just blows my mind that can happen from Fort Worth, Texas. That was something I would have never, ever foreseen.
And you're doing, which I think is, if you want to talk about like a mission statement of your life for you, which is to connect with people. And yeah. Why you left LA is to actually help people.
I never thought about
that. So how cool that you're doing that. It's very full circle. And I have been, you and I have talked about social media before, and I have had just like a roller coaster of it, because I have very, like, I have different circumstances where a lot of my followers, I felt like were inherited. And before J-Mac came on here, we were talking about imposter syndrome, and talk about imposter syndrome. I feel like I have these followers who want to follow me, not necessarily for anything I'm doing, but they truly cared, and that's why they were engaged. But that's the new mindset that I'm under now, is it is such a great way to get on and share small tidbits that really can make a difference with people and resonate with people. And like you said, you can just film it in your car and you're just connecting.
Crazy.
And that's always what goes viral, is like really funny, if they're funny or relatable, or small moments where people just feel really connected. And I think
100%. Being able to be just like truly sincere in the moment and authentic for like 20 to 45 seconds. If you can nail that right now, then you can expand your reach for whatever it is, whatever message it is that you want to spread.
I love it. I want to go back to Dad before I ask you some other questions. Well, this is kind of about you too. I interviewed Kelly Raspberry, and she said a few things that really changed my mindset about my dad that I hadn't heard. And this is why this is like very surreal that you can go back and interview people that, and especially Kelly. Kelly was with my dad maybe more than me, you know, she was with him. She had a very intimate relationship with him. And I was asking her favorite qualities in dad and that kind of stuff. But his mind was absolutely insane, the way he operated.
Yes.
And
manic.
Kelly said that she believed his creativity was so unmatched because of his ADHD.
Yes, yes.
And how he could have so many ideas at once and think of 88 things and execute them. So I know you have ADHD as well, and so do I. And Kelly kind of reframed it where she said that was his superpower.
Yes, 100%.
What do you think about that ADHD superpower thing? Because I know I can feel so much shame with my ADHD because I'm unable to do normal things that a lot of people can do easily. So tell me, let's talk about that.
You know, this is one of the first times that I got backlash. When I was on TikTok, I did a video about how ADHD was a superpower. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands or millions of views that it got, but it sparked a firestorm. And there were people on both sides of that statement. People who were like, absolutely, my ADHD is my superpower. You know, in select circumstances, right? And in select environment. And then there are other people who are like, how dare you say that the most disabling thing in my life is a superpower for you, because that is the thing that keeps me from joy and happiness and success. And that pissed a lot of people off. That was the first time that I was like, ow, that hurt, internet, you know, because I was getting fire and hatred from a lot of people for that. They didn't like that. And I honestly stopped talking about ADHD for a while after that.
But is that not just a prime example of negative mindset? That is just negative people.
But not all ADHD is created equal. You know, I am very fortunate that my ADHD is very hyperactive predominant, and that I have the privilege. I'm truly privileged in many ways, but I have the privilege of being able to pursue things that I'm passionate about, and all those other things, I I just don't. I get right. to ignore those things. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I've been able to be successful in a lot of different ways in my life. But because I've had those opportunities, because I've had that privilege, my ADHD has been able to shine because I put myself in the environments where my ADHD is an advantage and not a detriment, like the emergency department. It's weird. I mean,
prime example.
Yeah. I mean, people would probably think that like being a doctor with ADHD is a bad thing for patients. Well, it depends on what we're talking about. If we're talking about being in the operating room for 8 hours and being like sterile and not being able to like move and laugh and talk and stuff, like hell yeah, my ADHD would not make me a good surgeon for 8 hours. But man, my ADHD in an emergency department when I'm taking care of 20 to 30 potentially critically ill people all at the same time, people shouting things at me and alarms going off overhead and people calling me and patients yelling at me, and I shine because I can react. I can react at a speed in which people with ADHD cannot. And so my speed in the emergency room, my efficiency is, I mean, I am amazing. I don't want to say it like that, but I'm on a next level of somebody above somebody else who does not have ADHD, because it truly just like lends itself to that environment. So the biggest advice that I would give to somebody that has ADHD and is struggling with their ADHD is maybe you haven't found the right environment yet where your ADHD can shine, where your ADHD is a superpower. All those people that threw so much hate and fire at me for saying that ADHD is my superpower, maybe there isn't. Maybe there is no environment in which your ADHD is an advantage, but maybe there is. And maybe you haven't found it yet. And maybe you need to take a chance and take some risks and go out there and explore, you know?
That is such a great point, because especially if you're stuck in an office job at a desk all day long and you're never, ever feeling like you're living up to your potential, because the neurodivergent is right. not good in an office with a bunch of, you know, to-do lists.
I'd be the worst. I would be the worst employee for something that I'm not just extremely passionate and excited about.
Right. And then that takes a toll on your self-esteem, and that leads right. to, you know, it's a
right.
list for a lot of things. So
yeah. And people ask me, they're like, how are you involved with so many projects, many of which are successful? And it's because I'm passionate about everything I do and I'm excited about everything I do. And so my ADHD is just like laser focused on one thing at a time, even though like by nature, ADHD is like, you can't focus. Well, that's not true. In certain circumstances, ADHDers can focus to a much higher degree than other people, but we got to be excited about it. We have to be passionate about it. And the timing has to be right about it. Like I know when I'm like first coming up with a plan, an idea for an organization or for an event or something like that, I need to just clear my schedule and only focus on that, because there's going to be this burst of energy in something called hyperfocus that most people cannot do. I can do a full-fledged like branding, you know, with logos and the name of a company and the website and like a business plan. I'll do that within like 3 or 4 hours because I get so amped up about it. Talk to me 2 months later, I might be like, meh, on to the next thing. You know what I mean? Yeah. But you find the right people. You find the ways in which that is an advantage and not a detriment. You find the people that are also excited about that and be like, okay, I got this ball rolling, which is a really hard thing to do, to like mm-hmm. overcome the inertia of starting a project. It's really, really hard. But what's hard for me is not that. What's hard for me is continuing to like tap that ball over time. And right. so I have to find right. those people that are excited about the project that can keep that momentum going.
And that has everything to do, I think, too, with self-awareness and just being, we had a music meets medicine. So JMAC has two foundations that he runs. I'm on the board for his Music Meets Medicine Foundation, which is one of my favorite things that we do together, which we can talk about. I want you to tell everybody about yeah. what we do with Music Meets Medicine. But we had to go around on our first meeting and say our strengths and our weaknesses. And just having that awareness and being able to say, I'm really good at ideas, not so great at executing. That for me, that's what, you know, so it's, I think having that self-awareness, having those people that fill in the gaps is so, so important. Instead of shaming yourself into saying, oh, right. I need to be better. I need to be different. Why aren't
no, I? No, it's okay. That's one of the best things about getting older is you just accept the fact that you're bad at those things. And like, okay, we shouldn't just ignore everything that we're not like great great at or whatever, but like just lean into those strengths, lean into those strengths and find other people that have those strengths in those areas where you have deficits, and together you're going to be able to do wonderful things.
I love it. Okay. So I want to talk about music meets medicine and what we do there. But as I was prepping, I was thinking about mindset and how challenging it must be for you to keep. I know you've always been a very, very positive person, but I know having all of these people around you who are ill, and you've had illnesses in your family quite a bit.
Yes.
And so I want to talk about positive mindset, but I also was thinking too, I want you to speak on how you think positivity, and I don't want to sound woo-woo again, but have you seen a correlation with your patients who have a positive mindset over a negative mindset? Do you think that there's something there?
Well, that's a really difficult thing to answer as a doctor, because I, with the timeline in which I take care of patients, it's very short. Mm-hmm. They're coming in when things are the worst usually. And then I don't usually, you know, follow them for more than the first like 5 or 6 hours of their acute illness. So I can't really speak on my personal experience with the power of positivity and kind of like long-term outcomes. I know that, I mean, high cortisol levels, high stress as you're going through these experiences is absolutely detrimental to outcomes. And that is very measurable, you know, but science, you get people that if you can't measure something, it doesn't exist, you know,
right.
In the world of science. And there isn't too much that is measurable that I'm aware of with, you know, kind of positive mindset and stuff.
So what about
my heart of hearts believes that. Absolutely believes that positivity is important for outcomes, but I don't have any papers to back it up or anything.
Okay. So you didn't hear it here first. So there's,
yeah.
We do with music, there is science that can back the healing powers of music. Correct.
Here's the thing. When you are going through an acute hospitalization, there's more than just the medical outcome. There is the trauma of that hospitalization. There is the long-term mental effects of the PTSD that you get. Everybody that truly has a life-threatening chronic illness will end up getting some form of PTSD from their hospitalizations, from their procedures. Mm-hmm. So it's more than just, Did your positivity put your leukemia in remission? And it's how much of yourself, you know, grew during this process? Mm-hmm. How much of yourself was lost? How many nights are you going to wake up in the middle of the night and think about that procedure, you know, where they violated, you know, your body? And to have distraction and to have goals like, you know, through music therapy, through writing music with music therapists, through learning instruments, either for the first time or picking up where you might've left off 5 years before. Those are ways in which, you know, your brain can come out ahead from these experiences, you know? And so again, to me, it's not all about measurable outcomes for an illness itself. And it's more about like who ends up coming out on the other side in here, you know?
Mm-hmm. How do you keep a positive mindset with dealing with and seeing all of these people on a day-to-day basis? How do you disconnect that, leave it at work and not bring it home?
It's tough. I think the mistake is to not bring it home. I think the mistake is to just like flip this switch when you leave the ER and pretend like you didn't see the terrible shit that you did. Mm-hmm. You know, I come home and I cry and I talk to my wife about things and I feel bad that I tell her about the terrible things that I see, but I have to, because right. If I don't, I'll turn into the same guy that I was before. I mean, a lot of people didn't really like know this about me. I don't think I shared this, but when I was in residency, I was burned out to an extreme level. I could tell people that their family members died and I felt nothing inside. And what a nightmare for an artist. You know what I mean? Like, that's like, to be a great artist, you're in touch with your emotions and you're able to connect with other human beings. And for me, you hit the nail on the head. Like, one of my biggest goals in life is to connect with other humans, and to not be doing that, I was failing. I was failing at my life goal, you know, to positively connect with as many people as I could. And I realized a lot of that, I mean, a lot of that is just the toxic, like, medical training environment and 30-hour shifts and just being, you know, honestly bullied by medical attend. I had a surgeon who would bully me on a daily basis and just try to bring me down. And I don't understand why. Like, why wouldn't you try to build somebody up? You're trying to make me a better doctor. You had this toxic, like, military mindset, you know? Like, I'm going to just beat you down so much that you're going to be a great doctor and you're going to love your pay. What are you talking about? I had thoughts of, like, stabbing that dude's tires, you know? Right. That right. Dude made me miserable and stressed out. And I wake up thinking about this asshole every day, you know? And, like, that's the kind of trauma that I experienced as a medical resident and as a med student. Thank God I am through that and on the other side. And I do take things home with me very purposefully. And I feel those things that I experience. And when I'm talking to a patient and I feel like crying a little bit or like tearing up with them about their diagnosis, I do. And it's a beautiful, we have a moment and they see that I care. They see that. And I'm not weak because of that. I'm a human because of that. Yes, I'm not a machine. It's a benefit and not a detriment to be able to feel emotions with your patients. And I've seen many doctors go back into their call room and you could tell that they were holding things back, you know, and they let themselves cry a little bit. And in the back of my mind as a med student, and I was like, oh, this is how I'm supposed to do things. But now that I'm a doctor, I'm an attending, and I get to do whatever the hell I want, I'm like, no, you felt that in the room. Let it out in the room. Show them that it hurts you too. And they're going to connect with you on a deeper level. And they're going to want to come back to you because you're a human. You're not a machine. And that's the difference between AI and doctors. And that will always be the difference between AI and doctors. You know, like, AI at one point may be able to just, like, maybe we're all going to have, like, CT scanners in our own house that just, like, you know, diagnose a problem. But you're going to want somebody who has held somebody else's hand through that experience and let them know that they're going to be okay. There's going to be some real low times coming up. You know, it's not going to be easy, but you're going to make it to the other side and you're still going to have this quality of life. And I'm going to help you get there. You know, like, that's what people want. They don't want this cold robot. And I hope anybody that's in the medical field is listening to this and realizes that, like, maybe we weren't taught, you know, right. And that maybe there, you can be emotional and professional at the same time.
100%. Empathy is our biggest gift and vulnerability is our biggest gift. And I know, yes, it can already feel so alienating being a patient in the hospital and to have a robot in front of you who doesn't seem to feel what you're feeling. It makes you feel even more alienated.
People don't want the doctor that got, like, 100% on their MCAT score. They would, right, like them to have done well on that test, sure. But they want the doctor with bedside manner that truly connects to them. And our job as physicians is to be the best that we can at both of those things, is to be the machine when we're in front of our computer and ordering, you know, the correct tests and the correct medications and making sure that there aren't any medication interactions, all that stuff. But it's also to connect with our patients. And all too often that second side is just completely ignored. And it's how do we order the right things and move as fast as we can?
So I would like to discuss a little bit further on what you're doing now, and especially your marriage, which is something that I really look up to. I think that you and Rebecca, and I talk about relationships on here, and I think one of the things that I know to be true about the two of you, which is what a friend told me when I was having hard times in my last relationship, he said, "Do you two have the same end goal?" And for me, the answer with us was no. And I think with you and Rebecca, you have the same end goal, but I know, again, you've had to pivot a lot in your marriage. She is a stay-at-home mom, but she was dealing with two kids while you were still in residency, and you guys have, she was with you through the thick of it while you were broke in med school.
Yes.
And I want to know the things that make your marriage thrive, especially with you having so many things that you're doing. And I know you have to be super, super intentional about your time with
yes.
your family yeah. and your kids.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, the answer is 100%, Rebecca. How many times am I going to cry on this show? The fact that I found another human being that loves me for who I am. I dated a lot of people before Rebecca, and people they love the idea of being with somebody who's been successful in multiple ways, but then they want to change you, and they're like, okay, that's really good that you're good at these other things, but now I need you to be this person.
Right.
And like, I mean, pretty much no human being can do that. It's just like truly change. I mean, you could change little behaviors, this and that. You could change, you know, like intentionality, like you were talking about with truly connecting with people and setting aside time for people. But at the end of the day, if somebody doesn't just like love and accept you for who you are, then it's going to be a struggle all day, every day. And that's what a lot of my relationships turned into, is because I drove them crazy because my ADHD, I talked about like that hyper-focus. I would hyper-focus on people in the beginning and I'd be like, you're amazing. And I would just, you know, lavish them with like just all this attention and always be thinking about them and always be focusing on them. But then at some point, I got ADHD and something shiny is over here, and it's not another girl necessarily, but it's a project and it's something exciting. I want to, you know, I want them to like run with me towards this other shiny thing. And they wanted me to go back to that first, you know, like a crazy explosive, moment that we had together. And I that's my ADHD is like where that passion is in the moment, and it'll come back eventually, but it's just not always going to be, it would just drive people insane. They're like, what's wrong with me? Like, why? But it wasn't ever them. It was just me. And the fact that like Rebecca is able to understand that about me and, know that I'm hers for life and I'm committed to her for life. And I'm not going anywhere. And that sometimes she's got to like wave her arms up and be like, hey, remember me? I'm that shiny thing too, you know? And she brings me back, and it's all her. It's 100% her and her ability to just be patient and so generous and so giving. And she's just the most amazing mom on the planet. That's her one and only focus is to be everything for our three complicated, demanding children all day, every day. And I just could not respect her more for having that laser focus. And we just balance each other out so well, because again, I can't, you know, from the minute I wake up to the minute I go to sleep, be focused on our kids. But when I am, and we're together, and this is something that was so freeing to hear from you, Caroline, is that, and I think I'm similar, you know, as a dad to yours, is I was like, did you feel like your dad was a good dad? And I was like, cause I'm afraid that my excitement and my passion, my enthusiasm for all these different things, I'm afraid that I'm going to mess my kids up, you know, that they're going to resent me. And you were like, no, I don't resent my dad. And he was a great dad, because when he was with me, he wasn't always with me, but when he was with me, I just felt all of that love and attention and that laser focus. He had it all towards me in those moments. And that just freed me to feel like I can still be myself as a dad and follow my passions, but still give them those moments where I'm going to connect more deeply and more energetically than most other people in their lives.
100%. And I remember that conversation, and it was so funny because when my aunt was here, we were also having that conversation about intentionality. And mm-hmm. if you have a parent who's very busy and not home as much, but I remember Shell told me that she remembers my dad sitting her down at Christmas one year and said, before you come into the house, and this can be with your kids or with your spouse, turn off the car, recalibrate, visualize the afternoon you're going to have with your kids. Go and be really intentional. He would literally take a moment and like put himself in the right mindset to go be completely engrossed in what I was doing.
And dad mode.
Like total dad mode, wasn't thinking about anything else. And I think with his ADHD, like that, I understand. That's why I respect him so much, because it is so hard to be ADHD and to be intentional. You have to work extra, extra hard.
Yes.
And for me, that's one of the things that I resent about my ADHD is I am an intentional person. I can't always express it because I have a million other things going on. Mm-hmm. So the fact that he dedicated that time to do that meant a lot to me. But also what I'll say too, and I don't know if I told you this when we had that discussion, and I can say this about both my parents, having them be exactly who they are. So for you, having you be at work, but also have these other charitable things that you do and have the music in your life and be dynamic, that makes me love my parent more because they're being totally authentic. With my mom, when my parents got a divorce, my mom had a huge glow up and she was putting herself first for the first time, as a lot of women do. You know, they get so focused on putting everyone else first. And had my parents stayed in that marriage for me, I would never have met that mom. And my better mom, because she poured into herself. So I think embracing that as a child and as a parent especially is so important, because it is so much healthier for a kid to see a dad doing exactly what he's meant to do.
Yeah, yeah.
Exact person that he's supposed to be, than, well, you're with me, but you're you don't have any passion in your life and you have resentment because you didn't take the job that you wanted. It is so much more beneficial for you to be embracing all of those things about you rather than taking things that you shouldn't so that you can be at home more.
Yeah. Truly. Yeah. I mean, and part of me feels guilty because I'll never be that dad that just like sits on a couch and watches trash TV. You know what I mean? And just like be present, but not be present. You know what I mean? But that's, I don't know. I felt guilty, until you freed me. You freed me with that statement, you know?
Well, it's the truth. It's just the truth. Authenticity is what you want to see from your parents. And if you compromise that so that you can be a loaf on the couch, that's not any better.
Well, the thing that I'm excited about the most is like finding out how to like, you know, grow projects with my kids, you know, we're starting our family band and we've started performing and they've had some big performances in front of like 200 plus people and they've done awesome. They've done great. And like, I can't like, that's the type of connection that I'm going to be able to have with them that not many other dads are going to be able to have. And I hope those are the things that they remember when they like judge me as a dad. Cause we're parents get judged, you know?
Oh yeah. And we're all in therapy fine. Now, you know, dealing with our problems, having
totally. I'm sure I'm traumatizing my kids in many ways right now, but I hope that they look back and like see that the intentionality of that, of including them in these different projects and giving them those performance skills, because, you know, I was put on stage when I was 3 years old. So the fact that they're performing, you know, at like 5 and 6 means like I'm behind the ball, like I'm blowing it.
Don't even with that. Do not even with that. No, but those intentional moments, all my favorite moments with my dad, and I got to do a lot of cool stuff. You know, I got to meet a lot of cool people. It was just, it didn't matter. It was the things that dad said, I could use your voice on this. Do you want to come in the studio and record this with me? Like, that's what I remember. It was just times where
quality,
he included me in things that were intentional that he didn't have to. So these moments will, I'm telling you, that they'll trump all the other little moments that you feel guilty about. They will. Yeah. And did you guys ever watch the Billie Eilish documentary that I told you to watch?
Yes. Yeah, totally, dude. Totally. Yeah.
I saw a lot of correlation between how y'all know Billie Eilish is my queen, but she was raised very differently than most people. And music was really, really prioritized in her house. And I see the same with you guys. And if we have parents listening that want to embrace creativity with their children, what's the best way to go about that? Because I feel like music is like trumps a lot of things in your kid's life.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. It is, you talk about intentionality. It is very intentional that my kids play music. And it's because I know that I can't just sit on the couch and watch trash TV and just like be in the house doing nothing, you know? So that is my way of connecting with them and also bringing something into their life that has brought me so much joy in mine. And, you know, so every single day, my kids and I will play music together. And that's just one of the things that I need to, you know, I need to execute on no matter what else is going on in my life. I got to squeeze it in. Even if it's just 5 minutes, we sit down together and we work on songs, and my kids can learn songs crazy fast now. It is insane. And they play and sing too. They don't just sing. They don't just play. They do both at the same time. And they're getting a real sixth sense about it. But I started when they were like four. So I started very, very young, and it all came down to trying to figure out how to make it a positive experience, you know? And it, when my son first said, he was like, I'm ready to learn guitar. He was four. And so I went to Guitar Center and I found like the smallest little guitar they had. It was called a Gitalele. And I had this weird tuning and I just tuned it like a guitar. I was like, well, let's just do this, you know? And so I kind of made my own like little like intro instrument or whatever for kids. And it was a little bit of a struggle at first. And then my wife was like, well, how'd you learn how to perform? And I was like, well, maraschino cherries. My wife was like, what? I was like, well, I would sing, you know, and I'd perform in front of my mom when we were practicing. And if I smiled, she gave me a cherry. And if I made eye contact, she gave me a maraschino cherry. And it made it fun.
Genius.
Yeah. I was like a seal, you know, like she was like throwing me fish to perform, but it worked. I mean, if it works for like animals, it works for humans.
Puppies,
Yeah. I don't know if somebody like hearing this, like may sound like terrible. Like I'm like treating my kids like circus animals or something like that. But I am so grateful that my mom did that for me, because to this day I can not play music for years and then, you know, pick up a guitar a couple of days before an event and perform. And I feel totally comfortable doing that. And that's because of those like funny little like positive reinforcements that my mom was able to find for me along the way. And now it's not cherries anymore. It was, I did cherries for my kids and it worked and it made it fun and they were excited. And like every time they do so, I literally just like scoop it. I'd have it next to me so they'd see it. Right. They know what they're going to get. And then when they did something good, I'm like scooping a little cherry in their mouth and they'd be like, woo, and their eyes would light up. But now it's Robux. So they love Roblox and they want to just like waste money in this game on this like skins and like little guns that shoot things for like all these. I don't know. I don't understand why it has so much value for them, but it does. And I just accept the fact that is what they want, and I'm going to give it to them.
We're going to bribe them to do it. We're
going to bribe them to do it.
It always works. 10 out of 10.
Yeah, and so it, 10 out of 10. And so anyway, so that's a long-winded way of saying that the intentionality of connecting with my kids through music not only brings so much joy into my life, deepens my connection with them, but it's going to give them a skill and an art form and a passion that they're potentially going to have for their entire lives. So it doesn't matter how you start. If you're out there and you want to get your kids into it, you just got to start and play it by ear and figure out what works.
And I think it's a great confidence tool and a great way to have some individuality for a kid, to have that confidence that they can do something on their own.
Totally. Totally.
It's so important.
Yeah. It's insane. My son will, if there's a piano anywhere in public, my son will just walk up and start playing and singing. And like, he'll get a little crowd of like, you know, five or six people listening, and he'll just sing a whole song at nine. I would not have had the confidence to do that.
No, I was always being told to sing and dance monkey, and I was always terrified. I would do it, but I didn't do it willingly. It was always.
Now, are you glad though that you were forced into those performances?
Oh, 100%. 100%. But also, it taught me how to talk to people, engage with people, because I wasn't just hiding in the corner. I was out there. So then people are going to come and talk to you. So I had to learn how to talk to adults and, you know, have a conversation. Mm-hmm. I ask a lot of people the same kind of ending questions. I am very curious to know what you think the definition of confidence is. I'm very enamored with confidence, and every person that I ask always kind of has a different answer for what they think confidence is and how to build it. So what is confidence to you?
One of my favorite quotes with confidence is actually from the sage, wise Mike Tyson.
Of course, okay.
And that's success begets confidence, begets success, begets confidence, begets success, begets confidence, begets success, begets confidence.
Yeah.
And because of the success that I've had in my past, I just became more confident over time to go out there and work my tail off and not give up until I became successful in whatever that would be. And then I got more confidence and then I went for the next thing. And I am so fortunate that I was given amazing opportunities at a young age to be able to feel that success, to be able to grow that confidence. And I don't think I had a natural confidence really growing up, but I just, with the opportunities that my parents put me in, you know, with performing on stage starting when I was three, I got positive feedback before I was insecure. Mm. And so I grew the confidence before I knew to be insecure. So the insecurity never really came.
Yeah.
So, I think being able to give kids an opportunity to shine at a really young age is the most important thing you could possibly do.
And then they never develop that feeling of insecurity to begin with. So then they're
right. Right.
Yeah. That makes sense.
And in like new realms where I explore and I eventually find confidence, like in social media and stuff like that, having been successful in the past, I feel like it's inevitable that I will find success. I just can't give up, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think I was talking to Travis about this, one of my best friends, is that to be successful in the entertainment industry, I mean, yes, like talent is so important, but just being like the most like unflappable human being, like just the perseverant human being on the planet towards whatever that goal is, like that's what's going to get you there more than talent. Mm-hmm. 10 out of 10 times your hustle and your grind, if you stay in it long enough, you're going to reach a certain level of success. You know, you just can't give up until you get there. So you work and work and work and work and work until you get that success. And then you get that confidence.
And then doing it scared. I think that's the biggest thing I've learned lately is you can always like, especially me, I want to do all my research before I dive into whatever it is. So I can take notes on how to be an influencer for 6 months, but the only way that I'm actually going to learn anything or build confidence is to do it. So I think so many of us wait until we feel ready, but I think just doing it scared is
Scared is a great, honestly, that's like a great quote, dude. I want that on a hat. I want that on a shirt. Do it scared. It's okay. Do it scared. Yes. 100%. But it also like makes me laugh super hard because have you seen that, We'll do it live. You know what I'm talking about?
What is his name?
I forget. It was like one of the big like Fox guys, like one of the big Fox News guys in like the 90s or something like that. And he like does a take and then there's something wrong with the teleprompter and he does another take and there's something wrong with the teleprompter again. And he realizes that he's going to have to do it like live on air in front of millions of people. And he's like, we'll do it live. We'll do it live. Let's do it. And then, but the minute that the teleprompter goes black and it goes live, he's like, and I'm Dak Shepard, blah, 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 blah. Thank you very much. And we'll say, you know, that. And he just nails it. I mean, he just nails it, but you can tell he was freaking out. Yeah. He was freaking out and he was scared, but he did it scared and he did it live and he owned it.
I like that. I'm sure Did It Live is already copyrighted, but if it's not,
we'll do it live
at the same time. I love that. Okay. Two more questions and then I'm going to let you go because I know you're swamped. Actually three. You have so much going on. What do you do in your life that brings you air?
Air. I don't know if I have too much air, to be honest, but the things that like keep me going and keep me centered are nonprofit work and music. 100%.
Do you meditate or do any of that stuff?
I don't. I probably should, honestly.
It's so hard for us ADD people to meditate.
Yeah. But my air is going from one thing that I'm passionate about and shifting gears completely to the next thing that I'm really passionate about. Mm-hmm. That's what centers me and gives me more energy. Because ultimately when you do things that you're passionate about, they fill you up at the same time. They're not just depleting you, you know?
Absolutely, you're right. If you had a playlist of your life and you had a few songs on there, what is in that playlist?
One song, one crazy ass, epic, drawn out, ADHD, schizophrenic song Bohemian Rhapsody.
I knew that's what it was.
Right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Because I take myself very seriously sometimes, you know, and I can get very emotional sometimes, but the next moment I'm just like this like ridiculous operatic thing. Yeah. Bada boosh, can you do the funding? You know? And then I'm like heavy metal sometimes, and I'm just like, you know, pedal to the metal kind of thing. And so I'm all over the board. But what a fun ride, you know. I feel like not me as a person, but me as my life. I love my life. Mm-hmm. Feel like this is a fun ride. So Bohemian Rhapsody for sure.
And then what keeps you looking up, J-Mac?
What keeps me looking up? I mean, wonderful humans like you in my life, my friends that fill me up. You talk about like doing projects that don't just like leave you feeling depleted, you know, having friends that fill you up, that don't sap your life energy, that
they give you air, maybe
level. Yeah. They give me air. Yeah. And maybe, and it's not space for me. It's not space, and it's not turning my mind off. It's people that fill me up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love it. I love you so much.
I love you, friend.
Thank you. Okay. Give everyone your handles on where they can find you. Pimp yourself out.
I'm about to pimp myself out. Pimp my ride. Yeah. Pimp my social media.
Pimp your ride. Pimp yourself.
So follow me, Dr.JMac. I'm at Dr.JMac on TikTok and on Instagram. I think I'm at Dr._YouTube. If you're on YouTube, I don't really have a big YouTube thing going on. But yeah, follow me if you're interested in what it's like to be an emergency doctor, on a daily basis, and just be passionate about 1 million different things and to never stop.
I love it. You're the best. Thank you so much for doing this. And we will be back next week with another wonderful episode. So keep looking up, y'all, because that's where it all is. I'm just gonna get stronger. Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to subscribe and rate Keep Looking Up anywhere you stream your podcasts. And to stay up to date on all my latest episodes, you can follow at KLU Podcast on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, or on my website at CarolineCraddock.com. And always remember, keep looking up, because that's where it all is.